Welcome to another episode of Sniffing the Pages. I'm Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And in this episode, we will be discussing Love and Other Things by Louise Leverett, a new adult novel about love, heartbreak and finding oneself. We'll also be discussing The Swap by Fiona Mitchell, an emotionally charged, insightful novel about two families dealing with a moral dilemma. But first, on to Love and Other Things by Louise Leverett. Do you want to start, Katie?
Or do we need to give a little bit of a blurb about it? Shall I read
you read the blurb, yes.
So, Jessica Wood is an aspiring photographer living in London. She's had her heart broken and her friends have pieced it back together again. She's doing okay. But across the neon lights of Soho, in the smell of alcohol and cigarette smoke, on every night bus, in every song, every time she tries to forget, she remembers him. Now, in a battle between past and the future, choosing between having a life or making a living, finding her feet or spreading her wings, Jessica must ask herself, who is she really living for? So,
what to say? I have some notes. Let's begin. So, yeah, basically, there was lots of things I found tricky about this book. I think one of the main striking points was how wordy it was. It was almost like, do you ever remember a program called Dawson's Creek?
Yeah.
Yeah. They, you know how, like, they were just young kids, but they just spoke in these really extraordinarily long sentences that...
Yeah, it is. It is very wordy.
It's like that on acid.
There's a lot of writing for what happens, if that makes sense. It's not, in any sense, concise. But it's not that she's not a good writer. I do think she's a good writer. I just think... that there was a lot more writing than there was anything else. I'm not sure how
there was lots of things that were unclear. I think there was a lot of timelines that were unclear. I think the main thing for me is that I'm right in the last editing stages of my novel right now, and I'm working with a brilliant editor. And so she sent me the edits back, and, you know, she's very... strict, is that the word to use? You know, so she's making me, you know, remove quite a lot of chunks of paragraphs and moving things around that don't work, and
getting rid of
words that just are unnecessary. And I just felt that there was just a lot of unnecessary words to get to a point.
Yeah, no,
a
I
bit
think,
like
I think
what
that's...
I've just done then.
I think that sums up it, because there's a lot more words than there is plot. Like, the plot is quite simple. It's quite, and that's not a problem. But it's quite straightforward, and not a huge amount happens from a plot perspective. So it's just it takes a lot of reading to get anywhere.
Yeah.
Through the book, and I don't know. Part of me wondered when I was reading it, is part of the problem that I'm just not the target audience for it. Like, I think it said new adult, just wait, is it 18 to 30?
Yeah, new adult.
I'm a bit older than that, not massively, but a bit. And so I do think maybe if you were in your early 20s, it might feel a bit more identifiable.
Possibly, yeah.
But I mean, the flaws that it has would still exist, for sure. But I think maybe the characters might feel a bit more identifiable, and that might help sort of, like, ease you into
the writing style. I think definitely it might be a book that could be specifically for that age range and nobody else. Whereas I will happily read a young adult novel or a new adult novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
I usually feel quite comfortable reading it.
Yeah, maybe this one. I read a lot of young adults. Quite a lot of young adult fiction. It's a really good genre, actually. But I think maybe just because this is specifically about being that age and the challenges of forging, it felt like it was written about a really specific life, and that me personally, I didn't really have anything to relate to in the characters.
Do you know what? I think I might have just worked it out. I think it's because she is that age. And because she's written about being that age. So she's very self-indulgent, and she's very in the moment, and she's living it. And
I think in some lots of ways, that's what you're like when you're in your early 20s, isn't it? That you are quite... things that maybe with hindsight you would look back on and think, that just doesn't matter. At the time, matter hugely. My major problem with it, actually, was just that it was never extremely clear. So it says in the back, she's broken up with this guy. She's recovering, but she's struggling to get over him. It was never at all clear why they broke up.
This is my problem with
this. And I kept coming back to this, like, but why did they break up? And then they got back together, and then they had issues again. And I just was never, it was never at all clear
what their issues were. And I think that I found that really frustrating because I just wanted to understand her as a character a lot more than I felt like I did. Like all the stuff to do with her work and her career did feel like understandable and relatable, perhaps if you're in that kind of you want a creative career and that's hard to get, and you have to decide, are you going to just get a job that makes you money, or are you going to, you know, what sacrifices can you make basically for that creativity? But the sort of love story side of it just felt unclear.
I totally put that, because I put things like, who is she? Where has she come from? What does she look like? I felt like I didn't actually get any description. When she introduced her friends at the beginning, there was no description at all of what they looked like. I had no feel for them.
Yeah, and I just felt she they just all felt a little bit
shallow.
Cookie cutter. Like, they were all just a little bit of a stereotype. Her friends, you know, they all fit. There's like the mouthy one, the gay one, and the mumsy one. And it just felt a bit, I don't know, they didn't have a huge amount of, stuff happened in their lives, but they didn't have a huge amount of real depth and real backstory, and I found that harder to engage with them.
I wonder if she, in 10 years' time, if she looks back on this book, if she would write it differently, because this book gets compared to Dolly Alderton.
Yeah.
But Dolly Alderton writes in her book, Love, can't remember the title.
Everything I Ever Knew About Love.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And but she writes anecdotes from when she was 14, 15, 16, 20, 21, 22. So she's a 30-year-old woman
back
writing
them,
back and reflecting, which I think is
I'd be interested to read other stuff by her as she gets grows into her voice a bit more. I thought it could have used maybe a little bit more editing, and it was just a little bit pretentious and self-indulgent.
It was trying to sound so poignant in places, wasn't it? But it just wasn't washing with me.
I think that's the problem, is it was trying to sound really poignant, particularly about that love story. So there was a lot of writing around the feelings of being heartbroken or struggling to get over someone. But I couldn't buy into it because I had no idea what happened between the two of them, and just didn't really ever feel invested in their relationship.
No, not at all. But this age group, 18 to 30, so that genre is mainly around leaving home, developing sexuality, negotiating education and career and choices and all that kind of stuff, which is all in there.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't really amount to anything, does it?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. Not my favourite, I have to say.
To pick out one page that particularly moved me in not the right way. So it was Checklist for Modern Romance.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is her checklist for modern romance. An electronic device for downloading free text messaging services. Cultivating digital friendships often involves a lot of backwards and forwards, so free messaging is somewhat vital. Could you not have just put mobile phone?
It just feels... I think that's exactly it. Like, it's a bit symptomatic of what's wrong with the book, is that she's literally just writing, you need a mobile, because everything's digital these days. And that's true, but it's very... It's a little bit overwritten.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see what she does next with that.
I didn't like the bit at the bottom of the checklist. Covers of books you will pretend to be reading. All sounds a bit whimsical, doesn't it? You know, that kind of sitting in parks.
Never pretends to be reading.
Reading the great classics, but not actually reading them, and just thinking about other things and thinking about poetry.
It's that kind of life attitude where it's like, it really matters. I think that's what it is. It's like that age where it really matters what other people think of your music tastes and what you read, and actually maybe this is just getting older, I don't know. I just think you like what you like. People like different things. Some people really like reading the classics and highbrow literary fiction, and some people don't like that stuff, and that's just fine. But don't pretend.
Yeah.
At some point you'll have to tell them that you really don't like reading whatever highbrow thing you've been pretending to read,
exactly.
And bring all your non-highbrow fiction out of hiding.
Yeah, so I just think she's still in a place, well, when she wrote this book at least, where she's forging herself in this world, and she hasn't really discovered who she is at all. And I think until you get to that point, you really aren't ready to write a book of this
depth. About that process.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it could have gone a lot deeper into it. I mean, she tried to be deep, I think, with what she was trying to write and the way she was trying to explain it. But I just, probably if I went back and looked at, which I do all the time anyway, go back and look at the writing that I did in my early 20s.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to go and do that.
Yeah, and I just think once she reaches an age, she might look back and think differently about it.
Yeah, exactly. I say I'll be interested to see what happens
because
next.
I think
she's
most
undoubtedly
writers
quite
do
a talented writer. It
absolutely,
just needs a lot of
honing in.
Yeah, refinement maybe, and a bit more careful, a bit more plot.
Yeah, basically. A lot of editing, a bit more plotting,
and a bit more character depth. Like some back, not, you know, not every character needs obviously like 20 pages of backstory. I appreciate that, but.
But we want to know
a bit more insight into
your boyfriend.
Yeah, and a bit more insight into who they are and why you slept with your boyfriend and what was it about the two of you that did or didn't work.
Because
even
like
when they were together, they were happy together. There was no kind of explanation of what was making them happy with each other. It was just like, when I was with him, I was happy.
Mm.
Which is nice, but it still doesn't give you any insight into their relationship or into them as characters.
Mm. Because you want to have that connection with a character, don't you? You need to have that to drive you through the novel. You need to know what their motivations are.
I personally, anyway, I really find characters very important in a novel and find being able to engage with them or relate to them in some aspect quite helpful. So. Mm.
But we'll look out for something else from Louise
definitely.
Leverett in the future.
Promising, maybe.
Yeah.
That's the right word.
Promising. And now on to The Swap by Fiona Mitchell. Tess has long wondered if Freddie, her difficult youngest son, isn't hers. Ginger, pale and freckly, he looks nothing like the rest of the family, and even her own children notice the cold way she treats their naughty sibling. But Tess never expected that she might actually be right, until a twist of fate reveals the terrible truth. During her IVF treatment, Tess's embryo was mistakenly swapped with a stranger's. For the past 2 years, Tess and Annie, the other woman, have been unknowingly raising each other's children. When Tess meets Willow, the daughter she so desperately craved, she becomes determined to reclaim the child as her own, demanding she and Annie swap their children back, regardless of the emotional cost. But Annie refuses to contemplate letting go of the beloved little girl she brought into the world. As the two wrangle, an unanswerable question is posed: whose child is whose? So first of all, to say that actually the children, even on the blurb there, it says 2 years after, but in the book, the children are three.
Yeah, they've just turned three.
So each woman has got each other's embryo, which actually, when you think about it, is quite a big deal because that's basically a baby, isn't it? An embryo, because that's a fertilised egg with sperm from their father that's been fertilised outside of the body.
Yeah, so it explains right at the very beginning, doesn't it? They've got the same maiden name, and they both use their maiden name in the IVF clinic, so they were swapped over accidentally.
Yeah,
according to
right. And there was like a mix up with the A and the R because they couldn't.
One way or another,
A and the T, and it didn't look.
Putting the wrong person. Basically.
So it's Tess that has Freddie, who is essentially Annie's child, and Annie has Willow,
who is Tess's biological child.
Tess's biological child. So an embryo, and then Tess badly wanted a girl after the stillbirth of her baby girl.
Amber, so we can
say that because that's kind of running through.
Yeah, it comes out quite early that she has a baby girl, Ava, who was...
Ava, sorry, what did I say, Amber? I'm thinking of that other book.
There's too many books. Oh yeah, there was an Amber in that, wasn't there?
Yeah, Ava.
Yeah, so she had a stillbirth with her first pregnancy, and that was a girl, and then she went on to have two boys, and they went to have a third child, and they went for gender selective IVF because they wanted a girl.
Mm.
And then the mix-up happened.
Yeah.
And they had... so I think they did say they put into her one female and one male embryo.
Oh, that was it. She said just put them both in, didn't she?
Just in case, because she didn't want to throw away
embryo. She didn't want
any
more babies to die.
Yes, I think she couldn't...
So she didn't know what she was going to have.
No, but she had obviously really wanted a girl. Mm. It's such an interesting bit, because it does raise a lot of questions about what makes you someone's parent.
Mm.
What makes them your child? Is it biological, or is it... I don't think it is really. I think that's all that the kind of what it builds to is you build a relationship with your child beyond biology.
Mm. It's the whole nature nurture debate, isn't it? But which kind of ever evolving and never really ends, specifically as things like IVF come into play and more ways of
women being able to have babies, then I think the lines become even more blurred about nature and nurture. And so the
whole book was so interesting. I really enjoyed reading it because I just kept thinking, I don't know how this is going to resolve.
Mm.
I can't think how this is going to resolve, that's going to be good for anybody. Like, it's such an absolute cock-up. How do you resolve that situation? Like, there's no right answer. There isn't.
No.
Everybody involved is emotionally invested in so many different ways, and it's got everyone's feelings and emotions are running so high, and
everybody's going to get messed up somehow. There's
two three-year-olds who just don't know what the hell is going on. It's just so painful.
Mm. So the reason they find out that their children are not their own is because Tess is in a car accident with Freddie. So Freddie's got these behavioural issues, hasn't he? So which keep coming out throughout the book, and then we find out later on that he does have some brain issues that have perhaps been affecting his temperament. So the car crash then means they're in hospital, so then they discover that the DNA are not connected at all. So
yeah, they think he needs a blood transfusion. Yeah. And they find out that he's an impossible blood type to have got from his parents' blood types. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So he's genetically impossible that he could be the blood type he is, with his parents being the blood types that they are. And so after that, they go away and get a DNA test, thinking, well, we've got to understand. And I guess it's particularly because Tess has had this problem bonding with him. She wants there to be an explanation. Like, yeah. She wants to understand, why don't I feel connected to this child in the right way, the way I should feel about a baby that I've had. And then this is a really nice, obvious explanation for her. It's always because he's not biologically mine. And that's, clearly that's not the real reason. The real reason is to do with her issues. But, she jumps on it, and then they sort of pursue this process.
So that's interesting that you say that then, because just to go down that whole nature-nurture debate, obviously he has these issues which then reflect on her behaviour towards him, and then the two just keep kind of falling out of sync with each other then, don't they?
Yeah, obviously, well, it says it on the back a little bit, doesn't it? Like, their siblings notice how she's different with him, and I think she thinks it's because he's different, but actually it's partly because she's different with him.
Mm.
Like, kids, I think, I don't know, kids reflect yourself back at you.
Yeah.
Often. Like, I know when I'm tired and cranky and snappy with my kids, they're worse back at me. Like, we make each other worse. And you sometimes have to stop and be like, right, hang on, I'm the adult here. I should just take a deep breath and try and piece everybody out. So I do think, it's a lot of how she feels about him, how she feels about him not being a girl, the girl that she wanted, not replacing the baby that she lost in the way that she wanted.
And it's interesting that Fiona chose the age range to be 3 years old as the first, basically the first 3 years of a child's life, so the most delicate, because that's when the brain is laying down all the neurological pathways, and essentially a child becomes who they're going to become by 3 years old. And you can obviously reverse it with therapy and whatever, but they do say those first 3 years are the most significant for any kind of damage or goodness to kind of come from the child.
I also wonder if she made them that age because they're young enough not to know what's going on. So if you, it'd be interesting, like, imagine if this book, same situation, but the kids were 15 when you found out. Like, imagine being 15 and finding out that your parents are not your biological parents, or your child, you've been with that child for 15 years and you find out it's not biologically yours. I think in some ways, maybe in some ways it'd be more straightforward because you'd have had so much, I don't know, longer with them that you just would, thought that they weren't yours anymore. But I don't know, it's such an interesting book. It just raised so many different questions and thoughts, and like, what, such a messed up situation, and there's literally no right answer. And that's what I'd say, that's why what kept me reading was, how is this going to pan out?
Yeah. So the women, once Tess has found out, she then travels back to America, which is where she had the treatment done in the first place for the IVF. And then that's where she sort of spontaneously bumps into Annie, but doesn't know it's her initially, and then kind of this obsession kind of ensues, doesn't it, with knowing that she's got Willow and that's the daughter that she should have had.
Yeah, and she does become a bit obsessed, and so I think it becomes clearer and clearer that she's not she's dealing with psychological issues, or she's not dealing with psychological issues, and that they're manifesting in her behaviour in a way that's making her act more and more crazy, basically. Particularly, it made me think as well, particularly for Annie and her husband, This comes out of the blue, don't they? Doesn't it? So the clinic call them and say, "Oh, look, we're investigating. Someone's made a claim against the clinic. We're investigating all treatments that were carried out around this in this month and this year." And they ask them in for a DNA test. And so they had no idea. That's come completely out of the blue.
No, they were panicking that there was something wrong with the daughter.
I mean, there's a couple of things where they've been like, "Oh, she doesn't really look like either of us," but that's fine. Yeah. You know, I know plenty of people who don't look that much like their kids. You don't necessarily jump straight to, "Well, she's not biologically ours." So that must be, you know, the sort of implications for them are huge. This comes out of clear blue sky.
Yeah. But the book races along, and all the time I was just thinking, like you said, how is this going to end? How is this possibly going to end where... And then I was just sort of in my mind, I was heading for disaster, or I was heading for... You know, something's gonna. There's gonna be some major twist at the end, and
somebody did something awful,
and it was planned or plotted against them, or something like that. Which I'm glad it didn't, because that's just my mad mind that was getting away.
No, I did feel racing away the tone of it as well. The tone of it does build to some. I mean, I won't talk about the ending because people might obviously want to go and read it, and they should. It's a good book, but I had that sense through it because of the tension that all the characters are feeling in that huge building sort of emotional stress. I did feel like something awful was going to happen for quite a lot of it.
Which is good.
And it's good is writing. Good, definitely. And I'll say, I won't say whether or not it did.
It's good writing. Yeah, just on that note, I will just say that Fiona's writing is really, really good, and she's got a fantastic editor, because I'm going to kind of use this as my Bible, if you like, and keep it on my desk. I interviewed Fiona, and she talks about books that she keeps on her desk and things that she uses for reference points. And I just think this is a really good reference for any writer, just to show the style and just exactly how, you know, to edit a book to keep it pacey and the narrative flowing. And
it just really kept it, didn't kind of stumble
at any point to...
And, you know, gave a lot of enough characterisation to the characters that I had a feeling of who they were, both the husbands and the women, and even to a certain extent the children. That, you know, enough that I felt like I understood their motivations and where they were coming from, and it was good.
Yeah, and also it made me think about having children, because when I got pregnant with my third, I'm not ashamed to say that actually I romanticised about the idea of having a girl, because I had a girl first and then a boy, and then it came to the third and I thought I'd really like a girl again. And then he came along, and obviously I love him like a million more times than I did the imaginary girl that I never had. But there's something to be said about getting what you need and not necessarily what you want, and I think that's some of the ideas that cropped up as I was reading the book. Maybe even though they didn't get what they wanted, maybe that was what they needed.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a really interesting point, actually. So I think that, not even necessarily about their gender, but sometimes think about your children. Like, you have an idea in your head before you have kids about what your kids might be like. Not necessarily that that's what you want them to. I don't know. Maybe this is not everyone, but I had an idea in my head about what having a child might be like and what that child might be like. And my kids are not really. I couldn't have imagined them. I mean, they are a million times better than I could ever have imagined, but I could not have created, imagined them in my head. And it makes you think, yeah, exactly. They're not what I expected, but maybe they're what I needed.
Yeah, I mean, I've got two boys now, and yeah, they just drive me crazy and tire me out every single day. But obviously, that's what is needed in this family.
Maybe that's what you needed, to be tired.
Maybe
I'm tired
just meant to be tired and drained and frazzled every single day.
I'm about the same, so I don't even own enough to.
But yeah, I just think maybe I wasn't meant to have another girl, you know, when they're older and they're doing their boy things and become men and grow into the men that they're meant to be. Yeah, doing their man things, you know, shaving and spraying their armpits and with Lynx. That's what men do.
That is what men do.
Drinking beer and farting.
All the manly man things. Talking about cars.
Then, yeah, so... Yeah, that's my...
it's an interesting point.
Anyway,
in summary.
But she... it got to the end, and I think, yeah, that was how it needed to end. It couldn't have ended the other way.
I really enjoyed the ending. I was happy with it. I was I was so confused about how it was going to end, and I couldn't. It's impossible to predict because there just isn't a right ending. But then at the same time, I think the ending she wrote was right. Mm. All the way through, I was thinking, there's not a good answer to this. There is no, right. There's no right ending. No. But actually, the ending she gave it, I think, was right for it.
Yeah, so. Well done.
It's a very good book. Yeah,
good.
Recommend.
And this week, I was in conversation with Fiona Mitchell, author of The Swap.
Came across a story about an embryo mix-up just in the Metro newspaper, and I tore it out, and I just sort of put it into an ideas file. And then when I got some interest from publishers in my first book, I took the idea along, and I spoke to Hodder about it, and they really liked the idea. So that was where the idea came from. But I think I'm so interested in motherhood as a theme and the different ways that people can be a motherhood, and what, you know, there's so many different ways that you can be a mother.
Mm.
You can adopt, you can have a surrogate, you can, you know, have your own kids, or maybe you choose that, you know, that you don't want to have children at all. So yeah, I'm really fascinated by that subject.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So The Maid's Room, that was your first novel, and that was set in Singapore, wasn't it? So
yeah,
The Swap, the sections of the novel set in Florida. So are you familiar with that area at all, or did you have to go and have a lovely holiday?
No, I've been on holiday to Florida twice, and there's a lovely island there called Anna Maria Island,
right?
And it's on the Gulf Coast, and I went on holiday there twice, and I just absolutely love it. It's so laid back. And there's lots of lovely stretches of white sand. It's just so beautiful. And nobody really dresses up there. It's all very casual. And I actually really love setting my novels in a different country. I love setting a novel overseas. I just find I like transporting myself. And I kind of think when you set fiction in another place, you see the details of the place much more than you see the details of the place that you live.
Yeah.
You kind of take that for granted a bit, I think.
Yeah, book has definitely got some themes of nature nurture sort of muddled within it. So what's your stance on the nature nurture debate? Do you feel that essentially we are going to end up as a product of our environment?
You know, I am very interested in the whole sort of nature nurture thing, especially I do think it's still a really relevant topic. I mean, you could answer it and say, you know, it's 50-50, but the sort of concept of family is ever changing, really. And, you know, now you can, you know, people are having children when they're older, you know, women are having children well into their 40s. Some people are 50 when they have a child, you know, because you can have a donated egg, you can have donated sperm, you can find a surrogate. And so, you know, it's so interesting to look at all the different influences that a person has. A couple of weeks ago, I watched, there's a documentary, I think it's on Netflix, and it's called Three Identical Strangers. Oh, actually, I think it was actually on the television. And
yeah.
Did you see that?
I think I've seen that one, or I've definitely heard of that one. It's the three men, isn't it?
Yeah, so the three triplets who are separated at birth, and they don't realise they're part of this experiment. Mm. And then by chance, they come back together. And at first, it seems to be, they're very alike. Their body language is really similar. They've got really similar interests. And so you would think, yes, it's definitely nature. But then, of course, as the programme goes on, as the documentary unfolds, we see that actually they are really pretty different men. And that is because of the way that they've been brought up. You know, so it's definitely, there's definitely, you know, you do take from nature and you do take from nurture, but I'm just interested in looking at that.
Yeah, it's totally fascinating and ever evolving, I think, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
So just onto the novel, the swap keeps up its pace for the entire novel, and I haven't actually reached the end yet because I'm saving myself because I've got a few other things that I've got on at the moment. I don't want to rush it.
Yeah,
I'm really, really enjoying it, but obviously,
oh, thank you.
Don't give it away. Don't tell me how it ends.
I won't.
But I've read some great reviews, and I know that I feel there's something coming. There's something more to come.
Yeah.
So when you're writing this kind of novel, what do you do? How do you immerse yourself? Do you sort of lock yourself away for days, and once you sort of you know, come out of your room after your writing process, are you like a different person? Do you have to kind of, you know, treat me with care and be tender with me?
I think it depends what stage I'm at when I'm writing. I really don't like writing the first draft, and so I definitely don't immerse myself in the writing. I will try to do lots of other things, you know. I mean, I'll end up cleaning or going into the fridge to find something to eat rather than get down to the writing, because I do find that difficult, because when you first start to write, you don't know the characters, you don't necessarily know what's going to happen in the book. But what I absolutely love is when the first draft is out of the way and you've got something in front of you, and it will probably be quite rubbish, you know, but that's when I start to immerse myself, because I love editing. And, you know, for me, editing, you know, it's a total rewrite. I'm starting again, really. But I've got more of an idea about who the characters are and where the story's going. And then, yes, it can become really immersive, and I can get locked in it for hours. And yeah, exactly that. You know, when I walk away from it and I go out into the real world, I'm a bit distracted, a bit daydreamy, and people might ask me questions and I'll be like, what did you say? Yeah. And my daughter finds that very annoying. But yeah, it does go like that.
Yeah, I suppose it's different because you haven't got that blank canvas that you have when you begin a novel. Once you get to the editing process, you've got something really chunky to work with. So I guess that's a much more enjoyable experience.
Oh, I love it. I really do. Because, you know, you've got something to work with. And so you can character and you can, you know, you try to beautify the way that you've written something, editing out superfluous words and all of that. And I just absolutely love editing. And I don't just love editing my own work, I love editing other people's as well, so it's just my absolute joy.
Yeah, so that takes me on to my next question, because your career began in journalism, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so was that a pretty simple transition to become an author, or do you still work between both jobs?
Yeah, well, I'm actually I've moved away from journalism. I mean, I do write pieces now and again, but really, I've, you know, obviously it's very difficult to support yourself as just if you were just being an author. So I do editing for a couple of different agencies, and yes, I'm really trying to sort of push my career in that direction. But yeah, the jump from being a journalist, because I was a journalist at the time when I started to write The Maid's Room, it was really, really tough, because you know, when you're a journalist, it's all about reporting facts. You tell the story, you don't leave anything to the reader. The reader doesn't have to guess or be involved in the way that they are in fiction. So I found that really difficult. You know, we talk about in writing this show, not tell. But, you know, in journalism, it's all about telling. Yeah. So it was very, very difficult to learn that technique of showing. So that was hard. But what really did help, being a journalist, was when later down the line, you know, of course, you get I tried to find an agent and I had so many rejections. And then I worked with an editor, eventually worked with an editor who told me where I was going wrong. But because I was used to turning in work as a journalist and, you know, you'd often get told that that's not right, put a different heading on that.
Yeah.
What about this? You know, you're not precious about your work. You can take the criticism, and that helps you to get on. I think that helps you eventually to find an agent, because you do have to listen to people. If it's, you know, if someone reads your book and it's not working for them, you know, maybe there's a reason why it's not working for them. And so being a journalist definitely helped me become a novelist, I think, in that sense.
So you're not particularly precious when it gets to the editing stage, then? Are you quite happy to kill those darlings?
I don't mind at all, actually. I struggle to think of any time that I've been edited where I thought the editor wasn't right. There was one thing towards the end of The Maid's Room. One editor suggested that I won't give the plot of that away, but they suggested something to me, and I didn't feel right about it. And this wasn't an editor at Hodder, this was somebody else. And then my agent read what I'd written, and she sort of said, "Oh, I think it's just a bit too cliched, you know, but what happens at the end." And I was so happy that she said that, because I totally agreed with her.
Just needed that confirmation.
No, I don't think I am precious about killing my darlings. I mean, I had to kill a hell of a lot of darlings with The Maid's Room, because, you know, early drafts of it had all sorts of different characters in it. Because again, I didn't really know how to write a book all of those years ago, you know, just focusing on a few characters. I'm okay with editing.
Yeah. So was there a realization at your point in your career in journalism when you thought, "I really want to write novels," or is it always something that's been within you?
Yeah, it sort of started in my 20s, I think. I did English literature at university, and so, you know, books, I've always just loved reading. I love literature. And then in my 20s, every time I went on holiday, I'd get out a notebook and I'd start scribbling an idea for a novel. And then I'd start writing the first chapter. And then I'd get home and, you know, work would take over, and I'd look back at what I'd written and I'd think, "Well, that's absolutely rubbish." Throw it into the bin, and that was that. And then when I became a journalist, that really fulfilled the need to write. I absolutely loved writing, and it was, you'd write something, and then of course, you know, it would appear in a magazine a few days later, or rather a few months later, or you'd write for a paper and it would be in the paper a few days later. But with novels, of course, you have to be really, really patient. So
yeah, it's a lot of pressure.
I just felt so fulfilled by being a journalist that I totally set that desire to write a novel aside for a few years. And then you know, I had my daughter, and my husband got a job in Singapore, so the three of us went to Singapore, and that was in 2009. And I was only doing little bits and pieces of journalism then, and so my daughter started school and I had quite a bit of time. But it wasn't just that, it was being in a different country and noticing a different culture, and particularly in Singapore, I noticed the culture of domestic helpers and the way lots of expats were treating the women so badly. Nice. It really started me on this process of thinking, and the story started to form. And then I thought, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I could write a book about this. And but of course I didn't know how to do that, so I went off to the library and I got out several books on how to write a novel, including one of them was An Idiot's Guide to Writing a Novel or something like that, you know. The Dummy's Guide.
Right, okay.
That's what it was. And I sat down and I started to write.
Was that quite helpful, that dummy one?
Well, yes, it had lots of good advice in it. But I chose to ignore most of the advice. And I just set off and I had these two flagpole events and I started writing the book. And then, of course, I finished it. And then when I came back to the UK, I started sending out to agents. And then that's when I realised, I don't really think I've done this right. Mm. And then the whole process started of really trying to learn how to write properly, leaving the journalism aside. And it was just so hard. But I had, by really putting myself in front of the computer and writing 1,000 words per day, the bug got me. I just loved it. Yeah. And okay, it wasn't very good, and those early drafts, but yeah, I just absolutely loved it. I became really obsessed by it. I was doing it all the time, and you know, I'd get up early to do it, I'd work late into the night, I spent hours and hours.
I think books are really, really an important part of a writer's journey. You have to be able to have read a lot of books, I think, in order to kind of maybe find your style and observe how other people do it. So so first of all, do you read books whilst you're writing a book? Or do you just avoid that altogether?
Yeah, I do. I know some authors, they stop reading books when they're writing, but I'm always reading books. I feel motivated by, inspired really by reading other people's work. But it has to be a book that I'm really, really enjoying.
Yeah.
When I'm reading a book that I'm not enjoying, I find it really, really difficult to write. Whereas if I'm reading something really wonderful that I really connect with, then I think, oh yeah, you know, I
gets you on a high.
It does. And I think, oh, maybe I could do this. Yeah. I mean, you know, it never comes out as well as, the thing that you're reading, because obviously everybody's got an individual style. But yeah, so I do. I do read a lot, and I've always got a novel on the go. In terms of Kindles, I mean, I think Kindles are great because, you know, there are a lot of books out there on Kindle that are 99 pence, and you know, that's affordable for people. You know, they might not otherwise buy a book. So Kindles are brilliant. And my daughter's got a Kindle, which she's abandoned. In fact, I've stolen it from her because I've downloaded quite a few books onto her Kindle. And what I love about the Kindle is, of course, you can look up words as you go along.
Yeah.
I find that's great.
And you can just get a book at, you know, if you see something and you want it, you can have it.
That's right.
Become a bit of an addiction. Not that I have a book addiction anyway.
Yeah. But personally, I much prefer a physical book. I mean, I love underlining things in pencil and I love going back to look at things, or sometimes you might get to a point in the book and you might think, oh, I've missed something. Mm-hmm. Hang on, I need to go back to chapter 5 to see what happened there. Well, I don't know whether I'm not sure whether I just actually don't know how to use the Kindle properly, but you know, but it just, for me, you just have to like flick back through the Kindle pages, yeah. and it takes ages. So I don't massively understand Kindle. So I absolutely love a physical book. Mm. And yeah, exactly that. You know, I've got a teenager, she's 13, and it's all about Instagram and the phone, and then she's got on the computer. And that's brilliant. You know, she's really into, you know, computers, but it can be really unhealthy. And so I love the idea that with reading, she's getting away from technology altogether, and she's got, you know, 300 bound pieces of paper in her hand.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a really calming experience,
yeah,
for a child and for an adult. You know, it's just, there's just something really special about having a book in your hand, a real book and not a Kindle. So
I think it
is important, for kids to read books, and I think it brings them into a stillness as well.
Mm.
You know, because life is so frenetic, and they're not often still. So yeah, I think it can bring them into a calming state reading a physical book,
and you can extend that tangible experience into libraries and bookshops. I find love seeing my kids race into a bookshop and just become overwhelmed with the you know, with the books all sort of displayed there, and the same with libraries as well. It's lovely to see them just immersed, you know, amongst
the books. I'm such a massive fan of libraries. I mean, throughout my life I've gone to libraries, and you know, I still remember my childhood library.
Me too.
You know,
was yours like a really old building, a sort of grand old building? It was so not really like that anymore, are they?
No, it was a grand old building, and this particular library has closed down now, you know, like so many of them. Mm. It's so sad. And they've moved to another building, which is just a room, and it's run by volunteers. But I remember as a child, this place was so magical. Yeah. And you know, the wonderful thing about libraries as well is that you can get out several books. And you know, I went to the library the other day and I got out three books, and I was really fussy. I thought I really wanted to read the book that sort of tallied with my emotions and also what I'm writing at the moment.
Mm.
And then, so I read the first few lines, the first few pages of two of the books. And I thought, no, this isn't really what I'm looking for. And then I read a third book and I thought, oh yeah, this is it, mm. you know. And I read that. And also then that will make me go back to that particular author as well. So you can... libraries are wonderful places for discovering new authors, and then you can get, you know, then you can buy the next book, or you know, whatever. But they're just a wonderful calming place to be, aren't they?
Yeah,
just
I love it.
Surrounded by books and quiet, and you know, they can transport you to other places, and you know, there's so much knowledge in those.
I still get excited now as a 41 year old woman walking into a library thinking, I am surrounded by all these books and I can take them out for free.
I know, it's free. It's an amazing concept, isn't it, that you can just walk into a library and you can take these things for free and then bring them back. There's a lovely trust there, you know.
Yeah. So on to authors, and who inspires you as an author, or who did inspire you to write, and who still inspires you to write?
Oh gosh, yes. Well, definitely Maggie O'Farrell. I think the hand that first held mine actually was the book that I was reading when I wrote the first chapter of The Maid's Ring.
Mm.
Yeah, so the hand that first held mine. I loved that book, and there was just something about it at that time that really spoke to me. So yeah, she's a massive influence on me. I just think, gosh, you know, to be able to write like that, wow.
Mm.
But you know, there are other authors too that inspire me. I at the moment I just keep opening Celeste Ng's books, Little Fires Everywhere.
Right, yeah.
I just love that, the way that she jumps into so many people's heads.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just love the way the story goes. So those two writers at the moment are probably the biggest influences on me.
Yeah, I mean, they come and go, and I'm sure as your writing journey continues, so will your inspiration from other authors.
That's right. I think each time I write a book, I keep several books on my desk, and if I'm feeling a bit sort of...
What's on your desk at the moment?
So Celeste Ng is on my desk. Yeah, it's mainly that book. I keep just opening up Little Fires Everywhere, just in the middle, and I'll just read a paragraph and I'll think, that's it. That's how you do it.
Yeah.
And then I'll shut it again. but, you know, so, yeah, for each book I have, like, several books on my desks. So for The Maid's Room, it was definitely Maggie O'Farrell. I really loved her work. I mean, I still love her work, but, you know, she sort of influenced me to write The Maid's Room. And then with The Swap, who did I have on my desk at that point? I mean, there's a lovely book. You know, it's completely different to The Swap, but I just absolutely love this the way this writer works, and her name's Iona Gray, and it's called Letters to the Lost, and it's a historical novel, but there's something so upbeat about it. And so that was one of the books that I would open sometimes when I was writing The Swap. And you know, I don't write similarly to Iona Gray at all, but it just, I don't know, you feel like the writer is by your side,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
when you're writing, and it does inspire you to, yeah, you know, almost you need that kickstart by reading like a paragraph or two of somebody else's work to then get you in the mood,
yeah,
to settle down at your desk for hours to get on with it.
Yeah. So how's the writing process going now? Have you got another project on the go?
Yes, I have. Yeah. So I'm trying to write a third novel, and it's interesting, each novel that you write, the process is so different. And The Swap seemed to come quite naturally. Now the third book, I'm finding it really quite hard.
I've heard this, you know, that writing a third novel is really difficult.
Oh yeah, have you? Gosh, that's so interesting, because people would say, I've heard, you know, the second novel is, I mean, let's face it, any novel is hard, but I've heard people say the second novel's hard. And I thought, actually, I just really enjoyed writing the second one, but the third one I'm finding very, very difficult. But I think I've got into the groove of it now, because, you know, I think what happened was I started to write a number of different books, and I got so far and I thought, that's not what I want to write, that's not the idea. And then I've come up with this idea, and I wrote 40,000 words, and then I've really collaborated with my agent on this. She's got quite involved in this book, and I showed her my plot outline, and actually she was really great, and we had a whole brainstorming, and that made me realize that the story and the characters weren't quite right.
Mm.
So I decided to start again. So I discarded that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And I've started again, but now I'm at about 37,000 words. And again, I've started to think the plot is going to change quite significantly. Mm. That's okay. I think I'm going to carry on to the end so that I've got my first draft done, yeah, and I can, in the second draft, I'll go back and I'll start writing the voice as I think it should be. So yeah, it a different story altogether. There's quite a lot of sex in this one.
How's that to write? Especially you get quite a lot of help from your editor and things like that for those bits, yeah, can't you?
Well, I haven't shown them actually any of it yet. But yeah, it's quite interesting writing sex scenes,
isn't it?
I'm not actually sure that any of my there is a sex scene in the maid's room. But yeah, so there is going to be quite a lot of sex in this one. So yes, that should be interesting. My husband says I'll probably end up getting a bad sex award or something. So I've got to be like really careful, but we'll see how it goes.
And now onto the section we call What Katie Read Next. So Katie, enlighten us.
Right, so I read two other books this fortnight, quite different. So the first is by Jill Mansell, and it's called Maybe This Time.
Oh, nice.
And Jill Mansell's written lots of books, and they're all wonderful. And this was no different. It's about Mimi, and she meets someone called Cal in a farm with a sheep, rescuing a sheep. And they keep meeting and lots of fights. Basically, I hate the phrase chick lit because it makes it sound like frothy and silly and like it's not, you know, there's a lot of negative stereotypes about that phrase. But that's basically what this is. But I don't think that's a bad thing. It's an excellent example of the genre. And it's, I really loved it. I've loved all her books. And if you like that, if that's your sort of thing, then I would very much recommend it.
And is it new? Is it out?
Yeah, recent? I can't remember the date. It is out now. It's quite new. I think it probably came out in it's February.
Mm.
So only a couple of months ago. I got it as a birthday present.
Mm. Lovely.
And then the other one was a book I picked up in the bookshop a few weeks ago when I was at a train station with 20 minutes to spare and accidentally wandered into Foyles somewhat haughtily. And it's called Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi, and it's a young adult fantasy novel. And she sort of said it's based on...
Say that surname again?
Her surname is Adeyemi. Can we say that twice?
Adeyemi.
There's a lot of... I'm going to ruin the pronunciation. So it's a great book. I really, really liked it. It's a young adult fantasy novel set in a kind of fantastical... West Africa, I think, and it's about Zaylee, has got hereditary magic, but magic has been taken away from them, and then people who used to have magic are now treated as less than people who didn't used to have it, and it's about their sort of rising up and fighting back, and it's great. If young adult fantasy is your thing, then it's a brilliant book. It's really, you know, it raises a lot of issues around. I think a lot of young adult novels have this kind of, particularly young adult fantasy, that kind of allegorical thing where there's the story, but it's obviously got other meanings. And this is very much clearly a book about with that underlying message of racism and treating people differently because of the way that so everyone who used to have magic has got a really clearly identifying feature, which they've got very bright white hair. And so you're clearly identified as less, treated as less. And that's just that huge, you know, has huge... relevance to racism in our real world, and I think those books that can manage to have those messages but not beat you over the head with them in a way that feels jarring are really clever. And my only problem with it is that when I picked up the book, it said at the back that the next book was going to be due in March 2019.
Oh, for goodness!
Pushed back till December 2019, so now I'm waiting. I don't like waiting. But other than that, it was great. Yeah, really good.
So how did you know it had been pushed back?
I looked up the next one because I got to the end and it said the next book will be published in March 2019. And I went, oh, good, yay. I can buy the next one. And I went online and it said, no, it's not ready yet.
Well, obviously, she's working extra hard to perfect it.
It's a good position to be in. It's a good position to be in because it means that in December I'll have a lovely new book to read.
Mm. And is it a trilogy, do you know? Aren't they?
Yeah, I expect it's going to be at least a trilogy, sometimes even more than that. I don't know if it says anywhere. I haven't read anything that clarifies if it's going to be a trilogy, but I'd imagine it will be.
What's it called again for the listeners?
It's called The Children of Blood and Bone, and it's by Tomi Adeyemi.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it was.
On the next episode of Sniffing the Pages, we will be discussing One Summer in Paris by Sarah Morgan.
And The 7 or 8 Deaths of Stella Fortuna by Juliet Grahams.
So until then, see you later.
Goodbye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.